Oops. Wrecking the place already. Thanks, Denry. Now, I wrote something down. Hello, Hamish Alcoholica. I am a working erst git. That means that's my trying to say effect produced seeker in German. So anyway, gosh, that's a hard act to follow, isn't it? You know, no pressure at all. Wonderful. And yeah, it's absolutely wonderful hearing Andrea speak. We don't often get to speak together at the same things. So, you know, it's a lovely privilege to get to do it and to be invited here to do this with you all. And, you know, such a lovely welcome. It's been wonderful talking with all of you that we've spoken with. And, you know, it's just such a fantastic place to be at as well. So thank you very much to the committee for asking us to come over. I'm going to share my experience, strength and hope. I'm going to touch on, talk about service a little bit, because I've been heavily involved in service for the past 15 years. And but I am going to start at the beginning. So, experience, strength and hope. And, you know, the theme, with it being easy does it, I didn't do anything easily. I'm very contrary by nature. So as a child, you know, my family, my parents aren't alcoholic. Just get that clear now. They're pretty normal, or they were pretty normal drinkers. They're both older now and have both stopped drinking for health reasons. And they had no problem doing that at all. and they used to have parties when we were kids. They would have people around, and you know, there'd be quite a lot of drinking going on, and you know, they behaved themselves, which is quite amusing to me. They did not crash cars, smash up houses, sleep with each other's wives, husbands, etc., etc., and all that kind of thing. So, nothing like me. And but you know, before I drank, there was something different, which I didn't understand until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and started to identify in the programme. For example, I remember my mother telling me when my younger brother, I have one brother who's a year and a half younger than me, when he came along, I was a picture of a willing helper, running about, getting nappies, being helpful. By the time he was two, I was busy shoving him down the stairs when nobody was looking. So I'm not getting the attention, so he needs to go. You know, but I didn't realise that's what I was doing at that time. But looking back on it and seeing the traits, I can understand that now. Fast forward to the age of about five or six, I remember being given my first taste of alcohol by my grandfather. Small glass of Shandy Lager, about this size. And he had one of these old-fashioned cabinets where you open the doors and the lights came on. And it had lots of little glasses in it, all these wonderful different coloured bottles with different coloured liquids in them, and little cocktail sticks that were steel with different coloured tops. And I loved this thing. It was like some kind of magic TARDIS, and I really wanted to get into it. And so when he produced it, and it had these little mirrored glass shelves that you could pull out, and that's part of my story later on. We're not going to get into outside issues, but I'm going to touch on it. So mirrors, glasses out in the mirrors, I get given the Shandy, and I remember looking back on it once I started working with sponsor, and that made me feel like a grown-up. I was 6 years old, I was not a grown-up. The alcohol had an effect produced even at that age that had the power to change my perception. Clancy talked about the disease of perception. It's well recognised that from an early age, we think differently. Fast forward another couple of years, I'm getting bullied by two brothers and a friend of theirs. I'm being pushed about in a push bike. I kick one of them between the legs. His mum phones my mum, complains about me and all the rest of it. I get into all this trouble for it. So they've been kicking lumps out of me. So my answer to that is I go out into the back garden, I get a box of matches, and I light one match for every member of their families, and I bury them in the back garden by myself. And my mum came out and she asked me, "What are you doing?" And I was stupid enough to tell her the truth. Now, I had not read any books on voodoo, witchcraft, inspirational books, revenge stories, or anything like that at that age. That came naturally to me, dark and negative side of my nature. I used to get fly killer, the spray of fly killer, and I'd go out into the garden and chase the flies around the garden trying to kill them. And we get swarms of these midges in Scotland, they're horrible little things, bite you all over the place. So, that kind of behavior, there was no alcohol involved in any of that. None, whatsoever. So, when I got to you and started looking at the idea of having possibly been born this way, there was something different about me from an early age. Round about the same time, maybe a year or so later, I'm not going to go into details about it, it's not for an open meeting, but there was an incident in a museum with an older man that, I'll not go into details about, but it was abuse. And I never talked to anybody about that for that would have been probably about 34 years I never spoke to anybody about that before. And that's very important when we get to the fourth step. So, first time I remember getting drunk, though, I was about 13 years old, and I drank two bottles of cider that was 3.5% alcohol. So not very strong, but plenty for a 12, 13-year-old kid. And this was one of my parents' parties. The only person who was more drunk than me was a local minister. And he's falling off the end of the sofa. And that's very important as well, because God was not keeping him sober that night. I can promise you that. God certainly wasn't keeping me sober either. And what I was, and I ended up throwing up on myself, and my mother undoing my mum undoing my Dr. Martin boots that I had, that I was very proud of at that age at that time, and taking them off of me before I went to bed. Now, the next morning, I thought I'd had a great time, and I couldn't wait to do it all again. Now, that is not a normal reaction to getting drunk and throwing up all over yourself. So, as a teenager, I loved going out with my friends. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. It was all about who did the stupidest thing. It was bravado. It was all that one-upmanship, the showing off, etc., etc., etc. And I went to university. I used to say I got thrown out of the university, so I went to St. Andrews, which was a really good university. And I used to say I got thrown out of St. Andrews. My sponsor corrected me. I says, "No, you got yourself thrown out of St. Andrews." I couldn't behave. I'm going to tell you a couple of quick drinking stories. I'm not going to talk about drinking for a long time. But whilst there, two examples. One, I was in this party in a block of flats, and I don't remember this, but what happened was I'd left the flat drunk, gone upstairs one flight of stairs, gone into an open flat through an open front door, saw a single bed, and climbed into it and pulled the covers over myself. Now, that would have been fine, apart from a couple of hours later, this young woman walks into the bed and screams, "My God, there's a punk in my bed." All she can see is the Dr. Martin boots and a peroxide Mohican at the other end. Turns out she was in my geography tutorial class, and that wasn't very cool. It didn't matter very much because I hardly ever went to it anyway, so I never really saw it. The amends for that comes later. The other one was waking up in a flat that I don't remember going to, and I came to, and there was this dust bothering my nose, and I don't know what it was. It was like kind of just pestering me and annoying my nose, and it was bothering me. So I come to, and I'm like, lift my head up, and I've got my face in an ashtray. So I'm breathing in the cigarettes in and out of my nose, and there's something stuck to my side of my face. And it's like, what's that? I scraped it off. It's what we call a Scotch pie in Scotland. It's a meat pie. And I'd fallen asleep on top of this mince pie with my face in an ashtray. My solution to that was get rid of the mince pie. I need to get down to the Students' Union and get drunk. You know? Blackout. Don't even remember getting there, anything. But my solution was the alcohol. Fast forward again. During that time, I never ever thought I had a problem with alcohol. I just thought I was enjoying myself. I thought I was doing what everybody else did. Relationships never lasted. No problem getting into relationships, but they just didn't last because if we're not drinking, I've got no conversation, I've got no onboard power to deal with anything at all. Alcohol was my power. And without it, I was one of the, when I was younger, I used to spend hours just staring out the window going, what am I going to do in life? How am I going to fit into this? What am I going to do for a job? Am I going to get married? What's God all about? You know, but the one thing I never did when I was in these kind of deep, thoughtful ideas stages was I never asked anybody else what they thought. I just kept it all to myself and tried to figure it all out by myself. I was forming that boomerang that Bill Wilson talks about of self-sufficiency and alcoholism at the same time, where I'm going to deal with everything by myself and reinforcing it. I'm going to mention one opportunity that I had for asking for help. I was, again, about 14, and I was in a canoe on this river. I was in the Scouts, and I got separated myself from everybody else, got tangled up in some bushes, and managed to capsize the canoe, and there was a wall at the side of the river. So I was in quite a tricky situation with the branches coming over down the side of the river. It's quite deep. The canoe's sinking. I'm trying to stay afloat and hold up the canoe at the same time. And I'm scared. And I do this, I go, help. 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 And eventually, help, right? And three little girls come running. God shows up in mysterious ways. And they went and got the scout leaders who came and dragged me out of the river with the canoe and all the rest of it. But I didn't like asking for help. See how difficult it was even then? When we talk about drowning in a sea of alcoholism, literally was going to drown hanging onto this damn canoe. And, you know, finding it so difficult to just get those words out even then. And there was no alcohol involved in that either. So, as I said, back to leaving university, the drinking continues, all sorts of other substances come into play. I'm having psychosis, I'm living in a basement flat in Edinburgh, I think there's bodies going up and down in lifts at the back of it in a basement, drinking litres of whiskey, taking all sorts of other substances, and this is a very, very regular occurrence. And again, I just think I'm having a good time. I'm unemployed, unemployable, I don't care. I really don't care. If you've got a problem with what I'm doing, it's your problem, not mine, because you've got the problem with me, so therefore it must be your problem. That makes sense to me. How? What else? I can do what I want. So I remember going through these phases of trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's evil, and I try and figure it all out in my own mind and tie myself up in knots with it. And then just get drunk all over again. You know, I started writing poetry, dreadful, dreadful. I wasn't a French poet. Ever. But I used to write this really, really bad poetry. And I'd look at it in the morning and go, what is that rubbish? At the time, I thought it was brilliant. These fantastic ideas that are conceived while we're drunk. No idea whatsoever. So, eventually, I thought I was a free spirit. I really did. What I was a lost soul with a malady that I didn't understand, with an illness that I had no control over, none whatsoever. And it was progressing and getting worse and worse and worse. And more fast forwarding. I ended up in hospital 5 times. I got banned from driving 5 times. I'm in psych wards in a mental hospital. Halfway through my last stay there in 2007, I was sitting with the the senior nurse, and he said, Hamish, some of the staff know you here because I was a frequent visitor, and so we know a bit about you, but we don't have your notes because I got somebody else's place, and some poor soul, God knows what happened to them, but they didn't make it, and I got their place. And so I was quite honest with this nurse, and he said to me, the only thing we've got to suggest is entire abstinence. And I'm like, oh no, that means going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd been going to meetings off and on for 9 years by this point, and I didn't like it. I was so arrogant, I would stand in the back of the room when you said a serenity prayer like this. Just judging everybody. I'm not holding hands with you lunatics. I'm not as bad as you. I've got a shirt and tie on. It doesn't matter, I've been arrested umpteen times, done for drink driving, been in a nut ward, but I'm wearing a shirt and tie, so I must be different, I must be okay. Insane, absolutely insane, and completely selfish and self-centred. So eventually, again a bit of fast forward, I get out of the hospital for the last time. In fact, I'm just going to share on how that last drink started, because I'd had about 3 months of sobriety, or not drinking, I'll call it, before I ended up back in that hospital. So that's the summer of 2007. I'd been in a relationship, I'd ended the relationship, I then got obsessed with what she was doing, and she's going out with a guy 15 years younger than me and living around the corner in the village that she moved into to be with me. How dare she not move out of the village? It's my village, she should have moved out of it, yeah? So rather than just staying there and having the cheek to get this young boyfriend and go to the pub with her in front of all the people that I thought were my friends, drinking acquaintances, they weren't my friends. So I'm complaining about this in a meeting, and I'm jumping about a bit here. So coming into Alcoholics Anonymous at that point again, I got out of the hospital. I did the one thing I'd never done before. I phoned a guy who I knew had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous about 15 years and said, I can't do this any longer, will you help me? I got to that point where I realised that I'd reached that point of desperation that Karen spoke about last time. Yeah. The gift of desperation was there that I realised I couldn't do it by myself anymore. I still wasn't surrendered in a lot of ways, but I did reach that point where I couldn't do it by myself. And I asked this guy for help, and he said, yep, you'll need to come to me, because he knew what it was like. He'd known me for about 5 years by this point. He wasn't going to come and rescue me. He needed to see that I had the willingness to do it. And that willingness eventually came a couple of months later. And then I proceeded to try and do it my way for about 9 months, and basically try to tell him how to sponsor me. And I remember saying, I'm fine with steps 1, 2, 3, let's just do step 4. And I did do a step 4 and 5 with this man. And what I did in the step 4, which is really important, is I looked for my part. And I couldn't find my part in some things. And I'm just going to leave that there. And I wasn't completely honest in my 5th step. So back to that relationship that I've ended, and I'm basically stalking this ex-girlfriend who lives around the corner. I'm getting off the bus and stop early to walk past the cottage she lives in because I'm banned from driving for the 5th time. I got an 8-year ban, I was lucky I didn't get jailed for that one. I'm in the meeting in Dundee, where we live, and there's this guy there, and he's talking about sponsorship, he's talking about the steps in a way that I wasn't hearing very much. He's talking about travelling to lots of different meetings. He's talking about going to conventions. He's doing workshops. He's doing roundups. He's talking about people in America. I mean, that's miles away. It's a long way from Scotland. He's got a sponsor in America. I mean, what? He's got a sponsor that organises conventions for the state of Florida. You know, I mean, it's like crazy. It's like, what's this all about? I've got no idea. But the one thing I did notice about him was he wasn't affected by what was going on round about him, or he didn't seem to be. I was like an emotional sponge. You're happy, I'm happy. You're sad, I'm sad. And at this point, I'm all over the place. I want to kill myself, I want to kill somebody else, and I'm planning on petrol bombing somebody's house. You can guess who at this point in the story, right? And I'm sharing this in the meeting, and he says to me, I think I know what's wrong. Do you want to go for coffee? So the following day we go for coffee. He identifies himself in the doctor's opinion in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he identifies himself in step one in the 12 and 12. And for the first time, I get identification. We go through the different types of alcoholics that Dr. Silkworth talks about. The psychopath type, the type that swears off forever. The one that thinks he can drink safely after he's not drank for some time. The manic depressive type. And then the able, intelligent, friendly type. And he says to me, hey Mish, which one do you think you are? And I'm saying, well, I'm the able, intelligent, friendly type. And he says, you don't look very able, intelligent, friendly from where I'm sitting at the moment. You know, you're planning on killing yourself, killing somebody else and petrol bombing somebody's house. You're unemployable, yeah? You, by your own admission, you're absolutely bonkers on a daily basis. I wouldn't call that very able, intelligent, friendly. He had me. He said, yeah, okay. And he said, I said, but I'm not a psychopath. And he said, I didn't say you were a psychopath. It says type. It says manic depressive type. Well, I'm not manic depressive. Even the psychiatrist had told me I'm not manic depressive. The psychiatrist told me I had recurring bouts of depression. I'm like, yes, we know that. Anyway, I found out in step four that I was recurring bouts of chronic self-pity, but we'll get to that in a minute. So he's busy unpacking my delusions whilst we're sitting there having coffee in this coffee shop in Dundee. And then he says, how would you like to go through the steps with me? And I think I've done them. But I do know by this point that there's something missing. And I've never really looked at the idea of this spiritual disconnect, this lack of connection, this thing that some people seem to be able to fit in and feel okay in situations that I just didn't feel okay. You know, and you guys gave us that coming here. We just fit in straight away. We felt at home as soon as we got here because of your connection, because of what you guys do. I had no idea about any of that. And then, of course, he's talking about a spiritual illness of alcoholism. And he said to me, are you willing to entertain the possibility that perhaps you're spiritually sick? Now, I'm offended by that. But to be honest, at that time in my life, I was offended by anything you said that wasn't my idea. So, you know, of course I'm offended by it. Unless it comes from my thinking, it can't be very good, can it? I mean, God's sake, I got thrown out of university. I'm very clever. I know what I'm doing here. Jeez. So, anyway, this guy becomes my sponsor. And he gets me really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we start going through the steps of depth. And I never liked the God thing. So I'd always complained about him. That was one of the excuses I'd used for years, was I'm not doing their steps, stairs, whatever they call them, and all that God stuff. It's nonsense. I'm not going to any of your treatment centres because that just means I'm going to have to pay you back all that money. And, you know, that's just an excuse to keep drinking. And anyway, so, and he said to me instead, too, it doesn't say you need to suddenly believe in anybody else's God anyway. It doesn't say you actually need to believe in God at all. As long as you're willing to believe that there's some kind of power, even in a parallel universe, that's enough to get you started. And for somebody that was as belligerent and spiritually broken as me, literally wanted to kill themselves on a daily basis. I was on six different types of medication. I didn't know what day of the week it was. I drank on antabuse. I drank, you know, I mean, I was in and out of hospital all the time. No idea what was going on. And I believed him when he said, stick close to me. We're going to start doing this one step at a time. And I followed that guy and stuck with him. And he, Yeah, well, these t-shirts, I mean, you spend a lot of time in America, you spend a lot of time with old-timers in Florida. There's a guy that had been the archivist at Dr. Bob's house, Ray, and he had this t-shirt that said, "Shut up, get in the car." And I'm like, what is this, a cult? Shut up, get in the car. I mean, you know, and then I remember we gave a lift to some poor newcomer guy, and this guy was just arguing with him in the car, and he just dropped him off 4 miles outside Dundee and says, "You're walking home, pal. I'm not taking that in my car." You know? He was tough. He was mean and he was tough. But he got through my layers and layers and layers of defences, my layers and layers of rationalisations, minimisations, justifications. To the point where we're moving on. And he said to me, no offence with this at all, he says, "We're going to do your step three." And we did the step three. We got down. He says, "You can get down on your knees and do this. And if you want, you don't have to, but it's probably a good idea." And I did. And he said, "Right, if you really mean that, you don't actually have to do it ever again if you practice the rest of this program. If you really mean it." I've done it several times since then because I've needed to reinforce that because I've drifted. In my own thinking and in my own actions, I've drifted, so I've needed to repeat it. But that was the truth that this man was telling me from his own experience. Very soon after that, he said to me, "Do you want to go on a trip to the States, to Florida?" I think this was January, my sobriety date. It was 4th of September 2008, eventually. I said, "No, I can't do that." About 6 months later, I'm going to talk about Andrea first, actually. So, we went to this workshop in Glasgow. I'm going to talk about two things, first of all. One, he got me involved in lots of things, as I was saying. About March of that year, there was a wonderful guy in Alcoholics Anonymous called Tom Ivester, who sadly passed away a few years ago. Tom came to Dundee and did a workshop when I was, you know, less than a year sober. And Tom, my dad actually came along, and my dad listened to him speak on steps 8 and 9. My dad's like, "That makes sense." My dad is a very normal-minded person, and he just accepted it. It made sense. Tom talked about major soul surgery, about digging the poison out. And I was doing my step 4 at the time. And my sponsor at the time, Patrick, he was... "We're not looking for my part in this, Hamish. We're looking for my mistakes. We're going to do 4 columns exactly as it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we are going to resolutely look for your own mistakes. Because there's some things that you didn't have a part in, including that guy that had abused me in that museum when I was 7 years old. I didn't have a part in that. I was an innocent victim. But if I want to stay sober, I've got to get past that being a victim. If I want to have a happy, productive life, I need to move past that and find a solution that I can apply on a daily basis." And that's what he showed me how to do. And that's what I continue to do. So that was the starting point of that. Tom's workshop, we went at several other things over the next few months. Went to see Bob Darrell in a thing in Bournemouth, and I remember we were talking about step 6 and 7 at this point, and I've learned from that humility is something that I want because it's something I naturally lack. I can't manufacture it. You know, the 12 and 12 explains that beautifully. And I was sponsored using the big book and the 12 and 12 consistently. And, you know, we flew back from Bournemouth, and it was about an hour on the plane from Bournemouth to Edinburgh, and it felt like 2 minutes, because the conversation of just right in the moment, just one of those ones right in the moment, that connection was there. All this wonderful information. And then sharing it with people in the meeting, and people like, you know, it's just fantastic. They like seeing the lights coming on in people's eyes when they say there's hope in this. Right, that getting to understand, actually, that's what's wrong with me. That's why I felt like this. a couple of months later, we're in Glasgow. And there's this guy, Andy, used to run these Serenity Weekend things, and it was at Glasgow University, and they'd have AA and Al-Anon at the same time. Now, the AA guy was a guy from some treatment centre in Minnesota somewhere, and my sponsor knew of him, but he also knew of Mary Pearl T. And he said, we're not going to bother going to go and see the AA guy. We're going to go and see Mary Pearl because she's more like us and she's very much more like you. She's the neurotic type. And you need to hear this. And he said, there is no other side. It's the same illness. The only difference is they can drink safely. Now, that got my attention and it started getting my understanding. So I went to the Al-Anon workshop for the whole weekend. And Andrea came and sat next to us because of this lady with loss of hair halfway through the steps on the Saturday. And then in the evening, the session had finished. And I'm just toddling off, being self-centered, going down the stairs. I quite admired her backside when she got to go to the toilet at one point. I must admit that. But I hadn't really thought that much more of it. She just seemed nice. And so I'm toddling down the stairs out of this place on the Saturday evening. And my sponsor said, where's that nice young woman that was sitting next to us? Did you not let her know we were going for dinner? If she was by herself, she'd be welcome to join us. And I said, oh, I don't know. I think she's maybe still up there somewhere. So he said, go and find her and see if she wants to come for some tea. Don't leave her by herself. So I was like, ran back upstairs, find Andrea. Would you like to come for something to eat? And so she did. And then, you know, I was learning how to be a gentleman. I'd never been a gentleman. My idea of getting into a relationship was get drunk and stick my tongue down somebody's throat. And that was it. And I was saying, no, nothing else. That's just how it went. And then Andrea needed to go and meet a friend. So it was, well, go and walk her up to the traffic light so she knows what direction she's going in. So I walked her up, you know, and that connection thing was there. And I wanted to kiss her at the traffic lights, and I knew it was inappropriate. So, you know, you don't get to do that, but it's like, I want to, but no, it's inappropriate, you're not doing that. But I watched her walk away, and I could feel there was this connection, a soul connection, that I just didn't understand what it was, but I felt it, and I knew there was something was going to happen more. I just didn't know what it was. And that was really the start of it. And then the traditional courting. I've not got much time left, but just one quick story about when we were courting I quite like. The first time I went down, I was talking to my sponsor about it, and I said, yeah, I'm thinking I'll maybe just go down for like 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks just to see how she is. And, you know, see how it goes and so on. And he said, yeah, 4 days is good, and make sure you've got 2 meetings while you're there. So I went back for 4 days and did 2 meetings. The power in following the guidance, the direction, rather than running on self-will again. And we had a wonderful time. And whilst I was there, we went on a date, and we got fish and chips, and I think we had a thermos as well of tea, didn't we? And we went to this beauty spot in the out in the moor, not far from where Andrea lived. And so we're lying on this blanket with our cup of tea, behaving ourselves, kind of. And, you know, it's a starlit night by this time. And then there's these guys coming towards us in the middle of the night up the hill. And they were British Army on a blooming operation. And we were stood there. And I ended up having a conversation with a squaddie from Inverness whilst I'm on a date with Andrea. And it was blooming, so we nicknamed this place Squaddy's Clump because these soldiers appeared out of the darkness on our date in the middle of nowhere. So anyway, that was just an amusing time. But, so anyway, fast forward, I better talk about service briefly. But from 2 years, my sponsor suggested, by this point I'm into step 9, I'm practicing steps 10, 11 and 12 on a daily basis, which I still do. And he says, right, you need to go to intergroup. So I went to intergroup. He said, you don't need to say anything, just go along, listen to what's going on. Your presence is probably going to disturb everybody anyway. So I just went, and it probably did disturb them. And So I got involved in the interview up in Dundee. Then the regional chair came to introduce himself one day, and I'd never met him before. His name's Norman, he's now my sponsor. Norman said to me, "Hamish, do you want to come to region and just find out what's going on in region?" I says, "Yeah, okay, I'll come to region and find out what's going on." So I ended up going to region, and then they made made me the secretary of region. I'm like, "What? How did that happen?" See, Patrick was one of these guys, when you're asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, if it's a legitimate request, you say yes. If you're in doubt about whether it's legitimate or not, go and ask somebody before you say yes. It might not be the right time for you to do something, but this was the right time for me to do that. So I got involved in East of Scotland region. I was helping with prison service, I was doing PI stuff in libraries, school talks, that type of thing. I'd done some great stuff in the States, in South Carolina as well, visiting prisons there. I've not got time to go into some of the wonderful experiences. But basically got me involved in anything and everything that there was to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, including the service. And then the service stuff, I got to go to the General Service Conference in York and learn more about how the structure worked. And you guys are within CER. So, three and a half years ago, Norman, who's my sponsor, was due to rotate off the General Service Board in Great Britain. And so they said, "Hamish, would you like to be nominated to be on the General Service Board?" And I'm like, "I can't do that, I'm not retired. I run my own business. I'm not that long married." Great excuse, And that's what I'm thinking. So I spoke to my sponsor at the time then, a different chap. We had to part ways because I found out he wasn't playing the traditions at all. I don't want to judge the man, but he was not the right person for me, and what he was doing was very wrong, some of the things, so I'm not going to speak about that. But anyway, but at that point, I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I could become a trustee. And I spoke to this man, I spoke to some close friends that I trusted, and the majority of you was, "You probably can't do it." And I'm like, "Great, I've won. It's gone my way." He says, "But we can." And I learned one of the most important lessons I've ever learned, that none of us does this in isolation. It goes back to me asking that man for help when I got out of the hospital, hopefully for the last time. I can't do this by myself. I can't do the service by myself. And so I'm now due to rotate off the General Service Board next April, having served four years as trustee for East of Scotland region. And I've had Andrea's support throughout that, which is absolutely needed because it's a big commitment. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful learning experience. Areas of responsibility, I'm trustee with responsibility in Great Britain and continental Europe for probation and community justice. So there's a few things up on the back table there which are just some little bits of work that we've been doing. And if anybody's interested, please take them. I've also brought along a couple of structure handbooks. And just for information, these are available free of charge on the AAGB website. So anybody can get them, and they will post them to you, they're free. These are 2023. The up-to-date ones are on the website. I just didn't have any spare ones at home to hand, and I'd forgotten to get them beforehand. I've also got a flyer for a national convention in Blackpool, which is coming up next March. I've only got one copy, so if you are interested, I'll leave it out and you can take photographs of it if you want. But the service stuff has helped me develop love and tolerance. It's helped me realise that doing God's will is not always what I think it should be at a much, much deeper level. And that regardless of what's going on, I have a responsibility to always be there for the alcoholic that's reaching out for help. And my life today is completely different from that complete and utter lunatic that came to you people, and you basically gave me a new life. I was on 6 different types of medication, didn't know what day of the week it was, in and out of hospitals, drinking litres of vodka. Alcoholics Anonymous has replaced that through the power of this program, and none of us can do it alone. So thank you very much for letting me speak. It's wonderful to see you all, and God bless you all. Thank you.